From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered. It's our take on the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Eric Westervelt, in for Arun Roth. Thanks for listening. In this episode, in Tulsa, an experiment to help kids thrive by helping their parents get out of poverty.
Mostly it's like, how do I study 17 hours for this class when I have three kids at home and one of them that needs me full time?
Also, a potential game-changing, unprecedented reform. Prisoners locked up for nonviolent drug charges can now petition for early release.
This is absolutely more than symbolic. This initiative and announcement was unthinkable 10 years ago.
And jazz singer Renee Marie takes on the legendary Eartha Kitt.
Oh, she was scandalous.
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. Policymakers and thinkers have long debated how best to help low-income families break the cycle of generational poverty. A lot of people think one key is high-quality early childhood education. Others say equally important is support for parents with job training and education to get them into stable, decent-paying jobs. I recently traveled to Tulsa, Oklahoma, where an experimental program is trying to do both. It's called Career Advance. It gives vulnerable mothers access to high-quality preschool as well as to life coaching, financial incentives, and intensive job training in in-demand fields like nursing and healthcare.
And one of the things that cholesterol does is it's a precursor for vitamin D.
If you think a community college nutrition class has little to do with helping low-income families, think again. Struggling to get out of poverty, the two-generation approach. It's tonight's cover story.
If it's an interview, if it's your first day, if it's my first presentation with a group, I want to make sure I am like A, B, C, D deep in my childcare solutions.
About two dozen women, many of them single moms, sit in a basic workplace etiquette seminar at Tulsa Community College's downtown branch. All are enrolled in the Career Advanced Nursing Program. A few women roll their eyes. Much of this class is common sense stuff, but it's required. Organizers say the classes help the women improve communication skills and self-esteem.
What about handshakes? Has anyone ever had a wimpy, horrible handshake given to them? Like, it almost makes you make a facial expression when it happens, right?
The program is intentionally designed so the women re-enter the school and work worlds as a group to reinforce a we're-in-this-together ethos. Career Advance also involves rigorous hand-holding, including career coaches and financial bonuses, all linked in to good child care.
My name is Shatara Wallace. I'm 29, and I'm in the nursing program. I've seen it as a great opportunity. I've always wanted to go back to school, and they were going to pay for it. And so I was like, well, let me jump on this.
Wallace has two young boys, 4 and 9 years old, from two different partners. Her youngest son, James, goes to a Head Start program, the federal early learning program run by the Community Action Project of Tulsa County. A centerpiece of this two-generation approach is helping parents become good role models and to lay the groundwork for their kids to follow that pathway, not the one that got them stuck in the first place. Wallace tried to go back to school before and failed. She'd go for a semester or two and then stop. "I'm a master procrastinator," she says. For her, the program's big draws were the monetary rewards for good grades and attendance, up to $200 a month, and the career coaches.
They've become almost like second mothers. Because they really stay on you, they push you, and then at the same time, they're there to hold your hand, but just like a parent where it's like, okay, I need you to walk on your own and handle this, but I still got your back.
A little more about that. Do you have help with that, with a partner, or are you on your own?
I'm on my own. I do have a good support system. It's mainly the grandparents.
What do you think they're getting out of it, your sons? Are they getting inspired by you, you hope?
Sometimes I'll bring them with me if I need to come up to the school to study, just to let them know that, it's okay to go to school. You need to get an education, and my oldest kind of gets inspired about, he's only 9 and he already talks about college and things like that. And he's in the third grade. They have this test coming up, and him seeing me study, he wants to study.
When you get down about the program, maybe didn't do so well on a test, maybe your son's got a cold, trying to balance it all, What do you look to for inspiration to keep going? What keeps you focused?
One is, I do believe in God and the fact that I want to be able to give my sons better than what I had, to provide for them financially and, just even more. And so they keep me focused.
Okay. What if when they don't show confidence? Why is it awkward?
The program's only a few years old. It's a work in progress, and there are big challenges ahead. About a quarter of the women drop out altogether. A much larger percentage sign up for the registered nurse program and end up in lower-tiered nursing assistant jobs for a lot less money.
Mostly it's like, how do I study 17 hours for this class when I have three kids at home and one of them that needs me full-time?
Staffer and career coach Megan Elke notes that among women who stuck with the program through 1 year, three-quarters got at least one educational certificate. That's in keeping with the program's design, to get the parents at least some additional schooling credential that'll help them land a better job.
How much do we hold their hand and help them be successful in that first part of their training? And how much do we say, fly? We got a net down here. We'll try and catch you, but fly. Mm. So we go back and forth in that as well.
You have an emotional connection and investment in these people.
I do.
You take pride in their success. How do you feel when they fail? Because people do fail and drop out.
It's hard. It's very hard. Mostly what's hard is when I see their potential and I see where they could be if they did something different or made different choices. When they get down into the hard work of it, if I really believe that they could actually do it, they have the personality, they have the curiosity, they have that drive, but something has stood in their way. We can work around that, but you have to want to do that. And they see that now. They're like, I'm telling my kids they're going to college no matter what. It's not an option to just finish at 12th grade. And they said, no one ever pushed me that way. No one ever had me do that.
Many early learning and anti-poverty programs in America say they take a whole family approach and offer job training and other support services. But too often they merely offer referrals, phone numbers, and contact lists for services. Supporters here believe Tulsa's program is more in-depth and more focused.
And the intent really was to make the parental part of this much more intentional, much more intense, to connect the dots between what the parents are doing and what the kids are getting when they're going to what by all accounts, is one of the highest quality Head Start programs in the country.
That's Christopher King, director of the Ray Marshall Center for the Study of Human Resources at the University of Texas at Austin. He's assessing career advance and is an advisor to the project.
What the people who support Head Start in Tulsa came to realize pretty quickly was what moves the kids' success socially, emotionally, educationally over time and produces a lasting effect is when their parents are also making progress. For example, so if a mother increases her educational attainment while the kids are, say, 1-year-old, 2-year-old, 3-year-old, that produces not only a positive impact on the kids' progress, but it's one that endures through third grade, let's say. Same thing with income. If a parent's income goes up by $2,000 or $3,000 when the kids are young, it has an effect on the kids' progress, and it really lasts.
Policymakers and researchers across the country will be watching Tulsa's experiment closely. Professor Greg Duncan studies poverty and inequality at the University of California, Irvine. Duncan wants to see the long-term effects of the Tulsa Project, but he thinks they're on the right track.
It's more intensive and more expensive, but it's exactly that kind of more intensive experience that it takes, really, to make a difference for things like parenting.
But some critics have said, why should we financially reward people for doing what, we all have to do as adults, show up, be on time, do your work. These are our life skills most of us don't get extra financial bonuses for.
But if you look over the last 40 years, there's been massive macroeconomic changes that have worked to the disadvantage of low-skill workers, the globalization, computerization, technological change have really hollowed out the middle of the job distribution. So there's an abundance of service sector jobs. There are relatively substantial numbers of fairly high-skill jobs. But all the kinds of jobs that used to be around that required repetitive tasks like assembly line work, filing, and those kind of jobs are just gone.
Duncan also says wage levels for low-income workers are the same or lower than they were 30 to 40 years ago. Yet expenses for raising kids are much higher than they used to be.
It's to the point now, if you look at the difference between, say, the top and bottom 20% of the income distribution, families at the top are spending more than $9,000 per child per year on enrichment expenditures, high-quality childcare, summer camp, lessons, things like that, which is about eight times as much as families at the in the bottom 20%.
Greg, as we've heard, the women in Tulsa's Career Advance program, you know, like low-income people all over, have a lot on their plates and a lot of stresses. Your current research is looking at the impact of financial stresses on the brain development of children. What, if anything, do we know now about that impact of stress on learning and cognition for both the parents and their kids?
When you talk about a $3,000 car repair that you can only cover half of, let's say, that stresses out low-income families a lot and affects their cognition, whereas for high-income families, that's not true. We know considerably less about the direct effects of stress on kids. We know when the situation is very stressful in the sense of an orphanage or abuse or neglect. That can have very substantial impacts on kids. But for more normal kind of stresses that low-income families experience, which are extra burdensome compared to the kind of stresses that higher-income families experience, we need to know more.
That's Greg Duncan. He's an economist and professor of education at the University of California, Irvine. More cities are building up these two-generation programs, including Boston, L.A., and San Antonio. The funding to start Tulsa's Career Advance came from the foundation of billionaire oil and gas philanthropist George Kaiser, a longtime supporter of early childhood programs. But the Federal Department of Health and Human Services is now supporting it. So the big question is how you scale up and expand these kinds of programs to more cities and areas that don't have an oil billionaire ready to get it off the ground. Over the past week, there's been a lot of news about the grinding stalemate in Syria's civil war. International monitors announced that more than 90% of the Syrian government's declared chemical weapons have been removed from the country. But that news was overshadowed by allegations that President Bashar al-Assad's forces may be dropping chlorine bombs on civilians. Meanwhile, the U.S. government says it's providing more weapons to moderate rebels. In a moment, we'll hear more about the efforts to disarm Syria's chemical weapons. First, we go to one of the front lines of the war. Aleppo in northern Syria was once a vibrant city that showcased the country's diversity, history, and culture. Today, large parts of Aleppo are destroyed, and the fighting continues. Sam Dagger just spent days in the regime-controlled western part of this brutally divided city, and he spoke to us via Skype from the embattled Syrian city of Homs.
Well, at the moment, I mean, Aleppo is a de facto divided, partitioned city. The west side is controlled by the regime. The east side is controlled by the rebels. On the west side, it's relatively calmer, but also civilians are dying there, particularly if you're close to the front line.
Your reporting describes this intense schism in the city. On one side, people are trying to return to normalcy in the west, trimming shrubbery and going back to school. And on the east side, people are facing these devastating barrel bombs, these crude, indiscriminate weapons. And then occasionally the rebels will lob mortar rounds in the west. Is life going on as normal there or not on the west side?
No, it's not. I mean, schools are open, businesses are open. You have to remember also a lot of the people on the west side have been displaced from the east side. They're people who sought refuge, met a lot of people who own businesses and shops but have lost everything in the war. There's something the rebels call Hell's Cannon. It's like an improvised rocket with like a canister of gas attached to it. And that's supposed to like increase the incineration effect. So these horrible things are falling on some of the residential neighborhoods. So people are, no matter where they are, they're facing the consequences of this war.
Sam, it's estimated 20,000 civilians and combatants have been killed in Aleppo so far in the three-year civil war. If the Assad regime manages to take the east, won't it be the epitome of a Pyrrhic victory? I mean, how do you put this city back together again?
Well, it's very hard. I mean, both sides are now like locked in this battle till the end. It's all or nothing. I mean, that's the mentality I sense on both sides. the rebels, a lot of them now under the sway of Islamist groups. In Aleppo, you have even groups that are linked to Al-Qaeda on the regime side. They're like, we seem to be winning, and we are making headway in the center of the country, around Damascus, around Homs. But then you speak to commanders privately on the front lines, and they will tell you, frankly, they're saying, look, we're stretched to the limits because we're fighting all these battles around the country. The best we can do in Aleppo is just secure our positions.
Sam, we've learned this week that the U.S. is quietly boosting its lethal and non-lethal aid to moderate rebel factions. Is there any renewed hope on the rebel side, from what you know from your reporting, that increased aid will change the dynamic on the ground?
Well, that's what they keep saying. I mean, they want the anti-aircraft weaponry, but obviously there's been a lot of hesitation on the part of the U.S. and its allies that these types of weapons will fall in the wrong hands, and rightfully so, because as I mentioned to you earlier, I mean, a lot of these rebel groups, particularly in Aleppo, are under the sway of these Islamist factions. So I would say the concerns are legitimate on the part of the U.S. and its allies.
Sam Dagher is a Middle East correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. He joined us from Homs, Syria. Thanks for joining us, Sam, and stay safe.
Sure, my pleasure.
Today's the deadline by which the Syrian government was supposed to give up all its chemical weapons. International observers say 92% of the government's declared weapons stockpiles have been removed from the country. But there are a lot of skeptics. Amy Smithson is one of them. She's a chemical weapons expert at the Center for Nonproliferation Studies. Amy, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Let's begin with recent reports that the Syrian government may be dropping bombs filled with chlorine on civilians. What do we know about this?
Well, there have been several incidents where apparently this has taken place. The key thing to take note of is that these barrel bombs are being dropped by helicopter. And the only party in this conflict that's got helicopters is the Syrian government. So fingers right away point in the direction of the Al-Assad government.
This seems like such a crude weapon and tool, literally just packing chlorine and explosives into barrels and dropping them from helicopters.
Yes, it's about as crude as it gets. And let's also keep in mind history. We're approaching a sad anniversary, and that would be the 100th anniversary of when chemical warfare started. And chlorine and phosgene, both industrial chemicals, were the first chemicals used on the battlefield.
And if these reports are true, what does a chlorine attack mean for the ongoing efforts to disarm Syrian chemical weapons? I mean, this seems like a big loophole in the chemical weapons treaty, but yet chlorine is such a common industrial tool that can the loophole really be closed?
Seems is the accurate word to use there, because actually the treaty prohibits the use of any chemical, whether it's a classic warfare agent like mustard gas or a chemical that can also be used for industrial purposes, like chlorine, from being used to achieve offensive military purposes. So Syria is a member of this treaty. Syria may have violated this treaty if indeed this turns out to be Syria's responsibility for dropping these bombs.
Amy, some analysts believe that the Syrian regime will try to hold on to some of its chemical weapons. You think that's the case?
I do think that's the case, in part because Syria declared mostly what it heard the United States government say it thought Syria had in terms of a chemical weapons program, and that's just far too convenient to begin with. So I expect Syria to have not only additional chemical weapons delivery systems, but also additional mobile mixing and production facilities, perhaps an underground facility or two that they didn't declare that may have held back precursor chemicals. Those are the chemicals that feed into a warfare agent. And they can always tap into their commercial industry for additional precursor chemicals. So, quite frankly, this is a tiger that isn't going to change its stripes.
Amy, it doesn't appear that seizing Syria's chemical weapons has done anything to weaken the regime's military might or bring about an end to the fighting.
Well, unfortunately, that does appear to be the case, but that doesn't mean that this wasn't the right thing to do. In this particular instance, the United States and the rest of the international community, except Russia, are standing up and saying you can't use these weapons, that the norm against chemical weapons possession and use must be upheld. At the end of the day, this becomes a political decision on what punishment, if any, to send Syria's way.
Amy Smithson is with the Center for Nonproliferation Studies. Thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
This coming week, the Federal Bureau of Prisons will send a notice to every inmate in its custody, all 216,000 of them. They're trying to reach the people serving more than 10 years in prison for nonviolent drug crimes. Their message? If you've shown good behavior, have no prior convictions, and fulfill a few other criteria, you could receive clemency and go free. And the government will be working with a group of outside lawyers called the Clemency Project 2014 to identify which prisoners might qualify for clemency. I spoke with Vinita Gupta, who's helping lead the project. She's deputy legal director for the ACLU, and she told us that an effort like this is unprecedented.
We are being asked to both help identify and screen for eligible prisoners, but also to help pair eligible prisoners with lawyers. And because of the scale of this effort and probably the thousands of prisoners who will ultimately be eligible, this really required something above and beyond business as usual, and that's a welcome initiative.
How many nonviolent drug offenders do you estimate, you know, would qualify for release under these new clemency guidelines?
It's really hard to put a number on it. Right now, the only snapshot that we have is that there are about 23,000 federal prisoners serving who've served at least 10 or more years, which is one of the criteria for a nonviolent offense. But there are other criteria that require looking at the sentencing report, at the prison disciplinary record, and that require a kind of whole other layer of investigation and screening that makes speculation around the specific number kind of impossible to do at this juncture. But it's going to be, you know, in the thousands.
So this is more than symbolic. Several thousand inmates could go free.
This is absolutely more than symbolic. This initiative and announcement was unthinkable 10 years ago. It's really kind of marks a sea change in the conversation that this country and that policymakers are having. But it's also limited, and I think that's important. The impact is limited. The administration is doing what is in its power to correct an injustice. But ultimately, we need congressional action.
What's behind that sea change, do you think? I mean, this seems like a rare case where liberals and libertarians have sort of joined forces to try to roll back the drug war and crime punishment, the drug war. These have been big controversial issues for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, I would have had to seriously pinch myself 10 years ago to think that criminal justice was going to be one of the vanguard bipartisan issues in 2014, but that's what it's become. And I think it's really been motivated by a couple of factors. One is that the fiscal crisis in 2008 really pinched state budgets in a way, and pinch is an understatement, but forced states to reckon with the addiction to incarceration that they had been kind of feeding for 40 years. I also think that the historically low crime rates around the country really kind of opened up a political space, a less emotional, kind of fear-driven space to take a more rational look at what was going on and has been going on in our criminal justice system. And so now we are seeing states that are reforming a lot of their laws and continuing to experience really dramatic declines in crime. And that's broken the public perception that mass incarceration is required for public safety.
When might we see some of these nonviolent offenders walk free under these new guidelines?
We don't know. Our goal at the Clemency Project is to get petitions before the Department of Justice on a rolling basis. And the Department of Justice has said that they will be submitting them to the White House after they do their screen to on a rolling basis as well. And so it's anyone's guess right now, but our hope is that the president will be signing these as the merits persuade him and will not wait for some magic day, but will be using his last days and months in his administration to do so.
Vinita Gupta is deputy legal director for the ACLU. Vinita, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Eric Westervelt. Now for the latest installment of our series, My Big Break, about triumphs big and small. Dr. Samson Davis is an emergency medicine physician in his hometown of Newark, New Jersey. He grew up in a rough neighborhood. As a kid, he excelled in school, but didn't always stay out of trouble.
Just to walk down the street, I would see drug dealers. I would see people stealing cars. I would see prostitution. I would see people using drugs. And that was my surrounding. That was my backdrop. When I was 17 and a half, committed a robbery with a group of guys from the streets, and so dumb to think about it, but we call ourselves the Robin Hood of the community. We were going to rob drug dealers and give back to the poor. When the robbery took place, we jumped out the car and walked up to them and
sort of patting them down and taking things out of their pocket, I noticed another car pulled up to the scene. And literally within seconds, there was a sirens everywhere, cop cars everywhere. One of the guys that I was with, he's running past me, and you could see he look at me in my direction. I could see the fear in his face and the, you know, what was I thinking as he was being chased by the police and he was caught. So all four of us was taken off to jail. And then I remember I spent the summer between my junior year and senior year in juvenile detention with the crime that I committed. Had I been considered an adult, which was age 18, then I would have had a felony charge. And I'm quite certain I would have been given years in jail. And so when I was sitting there in that room and having moments to myself and in a cold room with a thin sheet, and I realized that if I didn't change my life around and stay focused more on the academics, that I would die on the streets. And that was my big break. When I returned to high school my senior year, that's when I made the pact with my two friends, and we made this pact that we were going to become doctors. We made this promise that we were going to figure it out. Being the first one in my family to go to college, I didn't know that I had to fill out a college application, and I had to take the bus to go to my own college interview. We made it to Seton Hall University and went on to medical school, and two of us became physicians, one became a dentist, but we all are practicing doctors in New Jersey and New York. Now, I was fortunate to come back home to my hometown of Newark, New Jersey, and practice emergency medicine in the same hospital that I was born in. I'm sitting in morning report with the rest of the doctors, and I'm looking at the board, and the board is made up of a medley of different names of patients who came in the night before who were shot, stabbed, car accidents, bar fights, you name it. And so I see the name Don Moses across the board, and I close my eyes and think, like, what are the Don Moses? I know a Don Moses. And this is the Don Moses I did the crime with, the robbery with, years ago. So I sprint down the hallway, hit the button on the wall, the double doors swing open. And as I approach the room, I start to see familiar faces. And lo and behold, it was his family. He had been shot multiple times and he had died. Literally, I had just chills throughout my body because it hit me. If I had decided to still stay down that same road, I would have been dead. I probably would have been lying right next to Don, who lost his life on the streets. To be back in Newark as the same physical being but with a different mental perspective, I feel like I went through these things in life. I never wished them on anyone, but certainly enough, if I can make it, anyone can make it.
Dr. Samson Davis, physician and author of Living and Dying in Brick City. We want to hear about your big break. Send us an email, mybigbreak@npr.org. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Eric Westervelt.
While tearing off a game of golf, I may make a play for the caddy. But when I do, I don't follow through, 'cause my heart belongs to daddy.
Singer and actress Eartha Kitt embraced the term sex kitten that was often assigned to her for her naughty come hither stage persona. Kitt died in 2008. She continued to perform well into her 70s. That's when an aspiring jazz singer named Renee Marie got to see her on stage for the first time.
My mouth was hanging open like everybody else's. I was drooling. Oh, she was scandalous.
Renee Marie recently turned that passion for Eartha Kitt into a tribute album. It's called I Wanna Be Evil, with love to Eartha Kitt.
So I want to warn you, laddies, though I think you're perfectly swell, that my heart belongs to daddy, 'cause my daddy, he treats it so well.
Renee Marie took a remarkable path to jazz. In her early 40s, she left her husband and her religion, Jehovah's Witness. She quit her job at a bank and followed her passion for jazz. As a child, Renee Marie watched Eartha Kitt play Catwoman on the old Batman TV show. She says that became an early memory of empowerment.
The first 10 years of my life, I lived under Jim Crow laws in Warrenton, Virginia. And so seeing this black woman on TV with all white people telling them what to do and just being mean and evil and reveling in it, it was almost frightening. Uh-oh, something bad is going to happen to her because this just didn't happen. So it was a huge eye-opener for me. She's like the perfect person to deliver the lyrics of the Cole Porter tunes because, as we know, Cole Porter wrote so many tongue-in-cheek lyrics and double entendres and suggestive lyrics. And who better to do that except Eartha Kitt?
That's why birds do it, bees do it. Even educated fleas do it. Let's do it, let's fall in love.
When we do it live, you know, I introduce the song, everybody knows the tune, Let's Do It Right, and I say, how does it go? And the audience starts singing, birds do it. They're really cute and light. I was like, yeah, but we don't do it like that at all. Here's how we're going to do it. We're going to put some blues up in there.
Yeah, it's great.
The Dutch and old Amsterdam do it, not to mention the Finns. Folks in Siam do it, just think of Siamese twins. Some Argentines without means do it.
I want to do a little compare and contrast here. Let's take a listen to Eartha Kitt's version of I Want to Be Evil.
I've posed for pictures with ivory soap. I've petted stray dogs and shied clear of dope.
You're pretty faithful to the original at first.
My smile is brilliant. My glance is tender. But I'm noted most for my unspoiled gender.
But where Eartha swings a bit.
Like something that seeks its level. I wanna go to the devil, wanna be evil.
You really take the tempo up there. You start to rock out there.
I wanna be evil. I wanna hurt flies. I wanna do things that scandalize.
Did you wrestle at all with how much to stay true to Eartha's takes versus...
Never. As a matter of fact, I tried my best to get as far away from her versions as possible because I was so worried. Oh, I don't want anybody to think I'm trying to sound like Eartha. Who could do that?
And in the theater, I want to change my seat just so I can step on everybody's feet. I want to be evil.
I got to tell the truth. What woman doesn't want to say that? I want to be evil. You know, we're just told to be good girls, don't ruffle any feathers, don't do this, don't. And then here's this great tune. I'm tired of being good. I want to be evil. So I have actually thrown out a suggestion to the women in the audience when we do this live that they videotape themselves singing this, you know, like buy a little get up, videotape themselves singing it, and then send it to me. So I can put it on my YouTube or my website.
Interesting. You got a little collection of I Want to Be Evil videos on your website?
Not yet. I haven't gotten one. But I have a feeling that they're coming.
They're coming. After this interview, they're coming.
I hope so.
And evil as I can be.
I'm speaking with singer Renee Marie about her latest album, I Want to Be Evil, with love to Eartha Kitt. It always seemed that she took on a bit of a character when she performed her music. I mean, she was the playful bad girl, the temptress. Did you do a bit of that too? I mean, did you get into character a little to record these songs?
No, it's not a matter of getting into character for me. What it is simply disrobing what's already there, uncovering what typically stays covered up. So being vulnerable enough to go to those places that the songs just were dying for, you know, for me to go to. Anytime you sing a song like, Oh John, you just have to surrender to what the lyrics are.
Oh, John, please don't kiss me. Oh, John, please don't kiss
me. I've gotten some criticism for some of the songs like that, but it's cool.
Why's that?
Because the lyric is, oh, John, please don't kiss me. Oh, John, please don't kiss.
Oh, John, please don't hold me. Oh, John, please don't hold
me. Basically, John is doing whatever he wants to do and seducing this woman. And some people have taken it to mean that it's okay for someone to continue forcing themselves on someone else in spite of being told no. And I've had women approach me afterwards and say, why did you sing that song?
Yeah, you wrote in the liner notes that, you know, you had the most trouble with Oh John, because the music moves sort of closer and closer to the forbidden, but no apologies.
None whatsoever. I did have to pull my husband aside and say, about that Oh John song.
Right.
Please don't touch me. Oh, John, please don't touch. Oh, John, please don't. Oh, John, please.
I mean, you care a lot about social issues, and your past albums reflect that, Renee. I mean, you've taken on racism and homelessness and inequality. Yet this album is pretty much all fun, almost tongue-in-cheek. I mean, is this the pure playful and fun side of Renee Marie?
It is so much fun. I had no idea how much fun I would have doing these songs. I mean, I love it. And as a matter of fact, I'm kind of dreading my next project, because if I do my original stuff, it's not going to be all fun like that, like this one is.
They say that I'm a witch, that I weave a spell. Well, I'll be a son of a...
Renee Marie, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very, very much. I've enjoyed talking to you.
That's Renee Marie. Her latest album is a tribute to Eartha Kitt called I Wanna Be Evil. Through five wars over 10 years, Ron Capps whipsawed back and forth between being a decorated U.S. Army officer and a highly regarded State Department official. As a frontline Foreign Service officer, he was also allowed to remain in the Army Reserves and serve for both branches in some of the world's deadliest places, wartime Kosovo, Darfur, Chad, Afghanistan, and Iraq. And all the while, Capps was almost daily in the midst of death and bloodshed. Slowly, he started to lose his sanity from all the horrors he'd experienced. He was haunted by dead civilians, villagers in Kosovo, women and children in Darfur, and beyond. Ron Capps has chronicled his struggles with post-traumatic stress disorder in his new memoir, Seriously Not All Right, Five Wars in 10 Years. The book opens in the African desert. The author's in a pickup truck in Darfur. In his hand is a pistol. A bullet's in the chamber. The safety's off. He's about to take his own life. Until his phone rings.
When the phone rang, I jumped, startled, and nearly shot myself. This would have been somewhat ironic because I was sitting in a truck about to kill myself and was already holding the pistol in my hand. But I would have pulled the trigger while the pistol was pointed at my foot rather than my head. After all the crying and shaking, the moralizing and justifying, the calming of hands and nerves, the intense focusing on the immediate act of charging the weapon to put a bullet into the firing chamber, and then taking off the safety and preparing to put the barrel in my mouth, the sudden ringing broke the spell and pulled me back from the brink. I looked down at the phone lying on the seat of the pickup. It was my wife, Maureen, calling from Washington, D.C.
Ron, your book is really about how you got from that point, from near suicide back to health today. Your title comes from the scale you created to monitor your own mental health. Tell us about that.
Right. I was in Afghanistan, and I was being treated for post-traumatic stress disorder. And my doctor told me just to keep track daily of how I felt so that we could talk about it. So I created a continuum from I feel all right at one end through vaguely not all right somewhere in the middle, and then off on the far end would be seriously not all right. And I used this scale to measure just how I felt. Sometimes day by day, but sometimes, you know, hour by hour.
There are a lot of chilling sections of your book, Ron. You witnessed a really a horrific amount of violence. And the breaking point comes for you in Afghanistan. You have panic attacks. You start to shake all over. You're unable to sleep. You clearly needed help then as you were in Afghanistan as a senior military intelligence analyst. Yet you were reluctant to ask anyone for help. Tell us why.
Well, initially, I was concerned that I'd be mocked and ridiculed by the soldiers I served with for breaking, for being weak. The second thing really is that I was afraid that I would lose my security clearance. As an intelligence officer, you absolutely have to have a top secret security clearance or you cannot do your job. And I knew that there were some medications. If I took those medications, it would require that my security clearance was at least questioned and I might lose it. What changed was that I had over 100 people working for me spread all around the country. I was the director of human intelligence operations for all U.S. military operations in Afghanistan. And I knew that if I didn't get treatment, if I was making those decisions in the condition I was, that I was putting their lives at risk. And I just couldn't do that.
Ron, I know from personal experience, journalism has come a long way in recognizing post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, it's gone from sort of you need a vacation and some scotch to realizing this is a serious, you know, condition that needs help and treatment. Do you think the Army has come far enough, as far as it needs to, in terms of releasing that shame and encouraging soldiers to get help?
I hope so. I certainly hope so. You know, when I left at the end of 2008, there was still a stigma of asking for help for mental health problems among soldiers. I think officially at the, you know, the general officer level and at the headquarters level, everyone says all the right things that, oh, yes, we're going to get you the treatment you need. But that may not have filtered down to the junior leaders level where things really matter among peers. I've actually talked to soldiers that I served with and or tried to, and a couple of them have come back and said, yeah, we knew you were struggling and it was okay. But a lot of them won't even respond to my emails or to calls.
Really? So soldiers you served with and know don't respond to your emails? You think there's still a bit of shame and embarrassment there?
I do, yeah. It's not clear why.
Do you think on some level among some soldiers there's a sense of betrayal? Look, you're putting some dirty laundry out there.
I don't think so. I would certainly hope not. This is one person's story. This is what happened to me. And, you know, I think individually there might be some people who just aren't ready to face what happened to me. Maybe they're concerned that, you know, it'll rub off or something.
Ron, in the book, you talk about the importance of bearing witness to war's horrors and documenting war crimes. And just speaking for myself as a reporter who's covered his share of conflicts, I would tell myself that too. You're bearing witness. This is really important. You have to keep going. But there's also, for me anyway, something overly earnest about that and a little dishonest. And I want to know from you, do you think you were also doing this dangerous work again and again in part for yourself?
Oh, sure. There was something inside of me during those 10 years where I knew that I wanted to be the man. I wanted to be the guy that was on the ground. I thought that I was someone, if not the one, who could get the story and get it back to a readership in Washington that included people who influence policy. I would also say that in many of these places, I was tasked to go and try to stop the fighting. And, you know, as many times as I failed to stop fighting or to protect civilians or to stop the killing somewhere, there were at least a few times that I did succeed.
So, Ron, you came home from Darfur, you got help, and in 2008, you retired from the State Department, and you went on to found the Veterans Writing Project to help veterans, in your words, write their way home. Tell us about that.
My personal experience was that I used writing to find the road home when medication, talk therapy, and large amounts of whiskey weren't working. And so I formed the Veterans Writing Project. We give no-cost writing workshops and seminars to veterans, to service members, and to their adult family members because we really want the family members in that circle as well. I've got a little sign up in my office that says, either you control the memory or the memory controls you. And I felt like writing was what allowed me to control that memory.
Ron Capps, welcome home. We're glad you're back, and thank you for your service then and now.
Thanks, Eric. It's a great pleasure.
Ron Capps, he's the author of the new memoir, Seriously Not All Right, 5 Wars in 10 Years. On the topic of religion, Bob Dylan once told Rolling Stone that he, quote, always thought there's a superior power and that this is not the real world and that there's a world to come. Dylan in the late 70s briefly became a born-again Christian, and as many fans like to say, he's now been saved from being saved, but that spirituality has always informed Dylan's writing. Back in 1969, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame producer Lou Adler experimented with that.
Even the songs that didn't feel lyrically religious in any way, there was a spiritual feeling to them. And as I continued to listen and within my mind's ear started to put together what if this was done by a gospel group, it just fit so perfectly.
Adler combed through the Baptist churches of South Central Los Angeles and organized an all-star choir for an album called Dylan's Gospel. That album yielded 10 Dylan songs totally transformed, and almost as soon as it got released, it vanished, becoming a collector's item along the way. Now it's been refurbished and re-released. One of the singers Adler recruited back then was the incomparable Mary Clayton. As a backup vocalist, she lent her voice to some of rock's greatest tracks for The Stones, The Who, Joe Cocker, among many others.
Most of the great, great songs that I have been on has been the cause of Lou. I think that was about the first time that we really worked together because it was Gene Page who gave me the call. Gene Page was a wonderful conductor, and the first song he played for me was Times Are Changing. And I said, wow, I've heard this before, but I've never heard it like, you know, the way Gene was playing it.
Did any of them say, Dylan, gospel, y'all are crazy? Or did they embrace it and say, let's go for it?
I think everybody embraced it because, first of all, we were just so happy to be together, you know, and to be singing together. Oh, my God.
It was family and
yes.
Happy to be doing it in these cases. Not a job, but happy to be at home.
And we yicked and we yacked and we talked and we kind of hung out. And Gene Page had a sister named Olivia. And she was like holding the reins when it was time to be quiet and do what you're supposed to do. She'd blow a whistle, you know.
Which didn't always work.
Right, right. Didn't always.
Blow the whistle, get back to work.
Time to get back to work.
And for the session, we had changed the feel of the studio completely. We had benches that were very close. We were trying to make pews, actually,
right,
is what we were doing.
Right.
Tried to turn the studio into a little bit of a
little
church.
A sanctuary. Huh? Yeah.
That's what we tried to do. It's also the reason that we stayed with just drums and piano
yes.
and bass, organ,
yes.
because that's what was going on in church.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I got to thank the musical gods, Lou. You didn't add too much overdub of
strings
and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, trombones.
we're really glad. Lou, tell us what happened to this album. It was released in 1969 and then kind of disappeared and has been out of print, as I understand it, for years and years.
It has. At that particular time, I had a deal with CBS Records, which is now Sony. And for whatever reasons, I wasn't comfortable with it and had decided to end the relationship. And it was probably within weeks of the release of this album, So it was never really distributed. And then Light in the Attic, which is a terrific little label, approached, and we were happy to make a deal to release it.
My guests are singer Mary Clayton and producer Lou Adler. Back in 1969, they recorded a series of Bob Dylan songs arranged as gospel numbers. They called the band the Brothers and Sisters. It's just been re-released. Mary, I think a lot of our listeners, like myself, you know, I got to know your incredible voice singing. Rape, murder, it's just a shot away on one of rock's most iconic songs. You know, the Rolling Stones' Gimme Shelter. I mean, that seems a long way from the gospel church scene in South Central.
Well, I was born in New Orleans, honey. And my father was a Baptist minister. So what's in your soul and in your spirit, whenever it needs to come out, it will come up, you know. So for me to sing Rape, Murder is just a shot away, called at 11:30 at night saying come to the studio, and I'm pregnant and in pajamas, you know, I just went and Rape, Murdered it and went home. You know what I mean? I raped and I murdered it, and then I was gone after about three or four takes. You know, that was it for me. Yeah.
Interesting. I mean, but this was a fairly hedonistic time, the late 60s in L.A. I mean, it feels, Mary, like, you know, these people needed a little churching up with this music.
Yeah, you know, well, we needed God. I mean, it was so much going on in the world at that time. You know, it was horrible racism, the war going on. We lost a lot of our leaders during that time. With all that stuff in my spirit, I was saying, hey, we needed shelter at that time in the world, you know, and I found myself just like crying out, somebody help us. And that spirit came over me, and I couldn't help but sing it the way I sung it.
Mary, I'm trying to get at the core of what makes a great gospel song. Do you have a favorite?
Yeah. His eyes on the sparrow, and I know he watches me.
Hmm.
You know, it says, like, why should I feel discouraged, and why should the shadows come? Why should my heart be lonely and long for heaven and home? When Jesus is my portion and a constant friend is he, his eye is on a little bitty bird, and I know he watches me.
But singing The Times They Are Changing, did it have a similar impact as these powerful lyrics you just mentioned?
Absolutely. Come gather around people wherever you roam and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accepted that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. For your time to you is worth saving. That was enough for me right there.
Then you better start swimming, or you'll sink like a stone. For the times they are changing.
To me, those songs fit the old gospel. These are the old, like, almost a spiritual. Come gather around people wherever you roam. Gather around, gather around. That's the stuff that they did in my father's church when I was a little girl. So it just, you know, I just loved it.
For the wheels are still in spin, yeah. For there's no telling who that it's naming.
It's Rock and Roll Hall of Fame producer Lou Adler and legendary singer Mary Clayton. Thanks so much for coming in.
A pleasure.
It definitely was a pleasure. Thank you, Irv.
And for the week ending April 27th, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West in Culver City, California. It's the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. Thanks for listening. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Becky Sullivan, and Daniel Hajik. Our intern is Stephen Jackson. Stephen is leaving us this week. Stephen, best of luck and thanks for all your help. Patrick Murray is the technical director, don't mess with him, and technical support from Marcia Caldwell. Muthoni Muturi is senior editor of Weekend All Things Considered, and Steve Lichtai is senior producer. I'm Eric Westervelt. Arun Roth is back next week. Remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Tweet us at NPRWATC. I'm at Eric NPR. Thanks for listening.